Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Paul Tanner from a group called Leavers of Bristol. They're the Brexiteers. Also, Alan Balding's father, Stuart, otherwise known as Tom Balding, worked with Frank Whittle on the jet engine, and also at a place called Ricardo Engineering, one of the top engineering firms in the 1930s and 40s, down in Shoreham in Sussex. Mark Wadsworth is a long-time West Indian union activist in the media. He's done a film, Divided by Race, United in War and Peace. And Ersan Koshbakht, he's an Iranian filmmaker. His film, Film Farsi, has been premiered recently at The Watershed. It's the carry-on film of Iran, if you can believe that, filmed before the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you've got someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show. So I'm joined by Paul Tanner from a group called Leavers of Bristol. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Can you give us just first of all why it is you're so pro-Brexit? I mean, almost so fanatically so. Then you've actually organised a whole group of people to get organised around Brexit.
That's a good question. I would start by saying before talking about my support for Brexit, actually one of the big reasons for the group was the fact that people that were leavers felt quite ostracised, particularly in Remain cities like Bristol. So the group, in fact, is more of a social group as opposed to necessarily a very activist-centred
group.
Right,
so you're kind of crying on each other's shoulders about how it hasn't happened.
More really just, I think, often having the opportunity to just talk about it in an environment where you don't immediately get into arguments or have awkward silences, etc.
I mean, this does happen in families, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, and families, friends, workplaces. Yeah.
Do you take it very seriously, the whole Brexit issue?
Of course. I mean, for me personally, I can't speak for the whole group. It's something I've been very EU sceptic since the late 90s, really.
So anyway, why Brexit? Why a Brexiteer and not a Remainer, Paul?
Okay, so I can speak for myself, not the entire group. But for me, it's always been the concern that the EU facilitates a lot of large businesses, their grip on... I have felt that it has, obviously, as it is its stated aims, kind of taken away sovereignty of Parliament. So it's taken away the control of MPs, for example.
But surely, I mean, individual parliaments just kind of decide for themselves, don't they, to what extent they go along with all this Brussels stuff. Some countries seem to be more pro-Brussels and just go along with everything Brussels says. Other countries push back more.
They do. I think my concern is it simply has created far too many areas in which Britain and other countries are simply not under control, are unable to control themselves. So obviously, you know, I know this always goes down badly, but immigration is one area. For me, there's a lot about control over things like railways and national industry that we no longer can nationalise under current EU rules.
Okay, well, it's just on immigration, because this is often cited as one of the main reasons why people voted for Brexit. What's wrong with having migrants? I mean, we're now in a situation in Europe where people are moving around quite freely, and surely that's actually quite good.
Again, it's not necessarily a problem with migration per se. It's possibly more of an issue of a lack of control. So, for example, I worked in the construction industry, and during from 2004 onwards, with the accession of various more countries into EU, there was a sudden influx of labour into this country. And I appreciate that was also a decision made locally, as in from the Tony Blair government at the time. They could have put caps on it, but they didn't. And that, for many people, completely
in the construction industries, that's good for you, isn't it? To get a lot of people in from abroad, maybe even having to pay them less?
Not if you're a tradesperson. So actually what happened there was, over a period of about 3 or 4 years, myself and many other people lost probably around about 20% of what we could earn per year. And also an impact on the business of construction is that there's been a dropping of standards, really, a kind of race to the bottom.
Can you give us any example of something you've seen in construction?
Yes. The quality of work has simply gone down because the pace at which it needs to be completed has increased. Obviously, as wages have gone down, businesses that are competing with lower wages are obviously trying to squeeze more out of their businesses and trying to get things done much quicker. And I've seen corners cut lots of times.
Well, it's really interesting to hear that in your own experience, you've seen standards dropping. That isn't necessarily the EU, though. Surely that's generally companies, deregulation. Anyone is, been in the construction business, I would imagine, has seen the pressure on the industry generally. Why is that directly connected to the EU?
It's all I'm saying is if you have a sudden uncontrolled influx of labour into the market, that then has an impact on the industry. Now, in some regards, that can mean you can obviously build, in theory, more houses and more buildings more quickly, but it does have a massive impact on the people already in that industry. So if you are used to a standard of living in this country and a certain salary, a certain wage that you can command, and that suddenly drops by about 20% in a number of years because of an influx of labour, that's an issue.
Okay, so the Leavers of Bristol is a group part of the Leavers of Britain. What sort of people are part of your organisation?
A complete mix, and one I would say goes against the stereotype you see of Leavers, which is often characterised as either kind of fairly white working class, or on the other side, kind of older, kind of conservative voters. I see people from ages of early 30s onwards who are a mix of professionals. We've even had, a university professor comes from Bristol, Bristol University, hospital consultants, engineers, a whole lot of people who basically feel unable, particularly in their workplaces, to talk about Brexit and to meet other like-minded people.
Are you saying that's a sort of Remain City syndrome then? That everyone is sort of got to be on the case? Why can't people just talk about Brexit and be a Brexiteer and in the same way as someone who's Remain? It sounds to me like you're almost feeling intimidated.
Certainly, and my experience has been, I think that's the thing that surprised me most. I can understand that people disagree with Brexit, and that's absolutely fine. I think what has struck me has been the level to which people feel they can essentially insult you and abuse you and make enormous assumptions about your rationale for voting Brexit. I find it quite extraordinary, and I still struggle to really...
So what sort of things do you get? Give us an idea of what...
I've had people assume that I'm racist, for example. That's the classic one, and it's driven by racism. I've had people assume that I'm incredibly right-wing and want to see kind of disaster capitalists come into the country and drive a race to the bottom.
I mean, isn't this the cut and thrust of debate actually something quite positive? People are saying to you, they're prodding you and saying, come on, justify what you're saying.
Yes, but I think what you...
And you probably do the same to them.
Well, I don't think you do get that same to and fro, though. I don't think people do prod people who are supportive of Remaining in the EU for exactly why they are supportive of Remaining in the EU. Now, when I do that, I very often don't get a very clear answer. More often than not, it comes down to kind of fear of the unknown, which, again, that's absolutely understandable.
But, I mean, if you're anti-immigration, it's understandable people might think you're a racist.
Well, did I say I was anti-immigration? I think what I'm more interested about is controlled immigration, so that you can actually plan for people coming into this country, so you can plan services, you can plan housing, you can plan, things like hospital care, which you can't currently.
I mean, isn't a little bit of hostility what you'd expect? Because Bristol is, after all, a Remain city.
Well, is it if you consider the suburbs around Bristol? I would say if you include South Gloucestershire and North Somerset, which you would say is a kind of part of the urban area, I think then if you look at the picture, it's far more kind of 50-50.
What about your experience at the Bristol Post? Because I know that you were approached by, or via, Mike Norton, the editor, and Kate Wilson there. What happened?
Okay, so that...
Because I haven't read this article.
That's because it's not come out. So it was a very interesting one, and I think it does say a lot about perceptions of Leave voters. So a group of us went along, seven of us went along, again, quite a mix of people. We ended up talking for 2.5 hours, which was great. The person interviewer was very, very friendly and very interested. And in the conversation, what we largely talked about were concerns with the lack of effective democracy in the EU, how a lot of decision-making is opaque, how, for example, you know, MEPs, what can they actually affect in terms of legislation? You know, legislation doesn't come from the MEPs. It's something that they can pass, but that's about all. So all these real kind of technical elements of how the EU works. And it got into about an hour and a half into the interview, and the interviewer actually stopped in a pause of the conversation. No one's mentioned immigration yet. She was genuinely surprised that actually there was quite a level of knowledge of how the EU works and largely our concerns were with its opaqueness and lack of effective
democratic process. The fact it doesn't really get discussed that much, the way the EU works, and one wonders whether journalists actually understand how it works. But anyway, so why hasn't it appeared? Have they told you?
No.
How long ago was this?
This was 2 months ago.
We're talking about the end of May.
Yeah, and I've been in touch a number of times since. For a while, it was, oh, I'm still planning to write it, da-da-da-da-da. But yeah, it's not come out. So I've made the assumption now that it's not going to.
Well, see, that's actually in itself is a little bit irritating and intimidating to give up your time for a newspaper, then for them to then spike your story. Look, let's get into Brexit itself, though, because coming up looks like Halloween. I don't know what you make of the, the rising of the dead or whatever on the day of Brexit. That's a bit of a weird one. Obviously,
I'm sure the date was chosen with slightly with that in mind.
Yes, maybe. Yeah, sense of humour maybe at Brussels about that one. But what about a no deal? Because that looks as if at the moment that's going to be on the cards. The EU are very adamant that they're not going to be changing the deal. The Irish have understandably put their foot down about the border. And what do you think is going to happen if there is a no deal in October?
I really struggle to believe that there will be a no deal. I don't think it's in Europe's interest. It's certainly not in, I would argue, probably not in this country's interests. But at the same time, I think if you enter into any negotiation, if you don't have no deal on the table, then you're not really going to get very far. And I think we've got to a point where it's too little too late. You know, Boris coming in now and threatening no deal a few months beforehand is not possibly the best way forward. But what can we do? We are where we are. This really should have been tackled many, years ago, really, a few years ago. And the fact that it hasn't has led to, I think, a great deal of panic at the moment, which is understandable because the threat of no deal is a concern. But I can't see it happening.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, what happens to people like you when and if we do leave on no deal and the economy tanks, that the pound falls below the euro, we suddenly find that the British economy is no longer strong and we are, I suppose, pariahs, really, because everyone is withdrawing all their investment from Britain. It's not as if we've got a lot of industry and jobs now. So if all that investment is sucked out of the country, people like Honda, etc., pulling out, it's not going to look good for those that have campaigned for Brexit, is it?
It's arguably not, no. But is that definitely going to happen? I mean, certainly there's been an issue with investment over the last few years, but that if I were a business currently, I probably wouldn't want to invest in Britain because of the lack of uncertainty of where they stand. It's not necessarily where we come out of Europe or not. Not Europe, EU. I always make a distinction between Europe and the EU. The issue, and I'm sure that this was part of May's strategy, keep kicking it down the road. So basically Britain does seem unattractive, and then you can start pointing to the way the economy is behaving. But if the economy is behaving poorly, it's because there's no clear sense of where we are. Are we in the EU or are we not? I'm sure once that question is answered, things will clear up.
Are you convinced we will leave?
I'm more convinced that we will leave to a degree now, yes, than I was from before.
Why?
I think it's just got to that point. I think that politicians, certainly a lot of MPs, obviously assumed that maybe the vote to leave was a short-term thing whipped up by Farage, for example, but it's not gone away. The support for it has never actually really gone away if you look at the polls. It's not going away, so I think leave is inevitable. I think Europe as well want it tied up as well, a lot of European countries, particularly France. So I think it will happen. How and to what degree it will happen. I suspect currently there will be a bit of a watered down version of the withdrawal agreement.
So some people say that the whole project for a united Europe has been going on for like a century at least.
Indeed.
And that
yeah.
this is something which has been being planned for a very long time, a United States of Europe. Do you think that that's a real worry, or is this just scaremongering?
So this is an interesting one, because obviously you can start sounding like a conspiracy theorist if you go too deep into it. But there's no doubt that after the Second World War, that was on the mind of a lot of people, and a lot of people wanted to work towards arguably a less democratic state of Europe, probably well-meaningly, because they didn't want to see what happened in the Second World War ever happen again. The challenge, though, with that, And I do still believe some people believe that and are working towards that. Certainly you're going to get a sense of that from certain pronouncements from, say, people like Guy Verhofstadt. But I don't believe that you'd necessarily get that from a lot of European countries and heads of states. So I think there's always a difference between heads of states in various countries and, you know, the various presidents of the EU. I would argue that the various presidents of the EU, that is probably their stated aim.
I mean, it's already become pretty obvious that as we disconnect from Brussels, we're reconnecting with the great American empire, and the US is going to be taking up. It basically means dumbing down the standards. The standards in the US are far worse than we've had with the EU. So isn't this whole thing really a step backwards?
Okay, that's an interesting thing. I don't agree with that. I mean, one of the things that was very, the Conservative government was, the May government was very quick to come out with, was that they would actually just take on board a lot of the existing legislation and laws from the EU and just take that into law. I don't believe that British consumers, particularly in farming as well, would welcome that move. At all. I really don't think that.
I mean, surely we've got to be in the sphere of influence of one empire or another. Britain isn't an independent country anymore, is it? We're too small, we're too insignificant. We used to have an empire one day, we haven't got one anymore.
Of course, I know. And I think Britain has always treaded an interesting place between the United States and Europe, and I think it will continue to do so. And I think, you know, this does sound a little, I can understand how people might think this sounds a little bit Little Englander, but there is something about our geography. We're an island, really on the edge of Europe. We have very, very close links to the United States. Obviously, the language is one of those things as well. And I think that position will always really keep England in a punching above its weight, to be honest, Britain, beyond its weight.
What's the worst case scenario, do you think? What are you really worried about happening when we leave, if we leave?
Do you know what? The worst case scenario, I wouldn't say is the economic one. I would say it would be the continued division in this country between people who want to remain in Europe and see Europe as some progress, although when you ask them what they're progressing to, they often can't give a very clear answer. I would fear that continued division, so that cultural issues that kind of it creates.
And what about best case scenario? I mean, is it possible to have such a, you know, is it possible to imagine a Britain where things get better? I mean, we've heard about a new golden age, Boris says, hasn't he?
Well, I think you have to take that with a pinch of salt. But I think what I would assume will happen is a lot of people, once it's over, will just get on with their lives. But I do still think there will be a number of politicians and obviously a number of people who are very, very pro the idea of a European federalisation and even world government, which is something I often hear some very pro-EU people talk about, they will keep pushing for that. So it will be interesting to see what the media does as well, because obviously, you know, we've already touched on the issue with the Evening Post, but it's very, very clear that certain elements of the media have been, I think it's fair to say, biased. So it'll be interesting to see what they do. Hopefully they'll reflect.
I think media tends to almost always be biased. It's just a question of degree. Mm. You know, do you think that there's been a bias in the whole coverage? And if so, how do you, you know, justify that?
Well, I mean, you're right to say there's always a bias in the media, and obviously some media is biased towards Brexit and some is against it. I think an interesting thing for me is that with various papers, you know, whether it's the Telegraph or the Express or the Guardian, you can choose to buy them or not, and you can choose to read them or not. When it's things like the BBC or Channel 4, obviously you can choose to turn it off, but it's part of our, a really big part of our lives and our culture, particularly if you're, I think, of a certain age, maybe over 30, when, you know, pre-internet, you did just used to watch the television and the few channels that were on. I think that it's been really interesting, actually, to see, I'm not really answering the question, but another thought's popped into mind. I think what's been fascinating with Brexit is how it's brought out various views of the world, and they are not, it's quite clear that they're at odds with, say, the BBC's view of the world. So it's actually, in the case of the BBC, I think is they've lost a great deal of support. You know, really getting people talking about wanting to no longer pay the licence fee. And I think there's a whole cultural thing that spills out of Brexit, which is more than just about Brexit, let's be honest. It's about certain views of the world.
I mean, the BBC have Nigel Farage on every 5 minutes.
That's what, in terms of on the question time, that's interesting that they say that, but is it tokenism, and is it there so you can kind of be bashed? I don't know. I would argue probably that's the case.
Okay, Paul Tanner from Leavers of Bristol. How can people sort of come along and meet you? Where can people find you, either online or in the flesh?
Okay, so if they go to leavers of Britain.co.uk, they can look up all the events that are happening up and down the country, including in Bristol, and all the details are there, and you can RSVP there. And the next event is on the 11th of August in Westbury-on-Trim.
So Paul Tanner from Leavers of Bristol, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Alan Balding. I'm in my 80th year, and I'm the son of Stuart Balding, who had a very interesting career working for Harry Ricardo in Shoreham-by-Sea.
Now, what was it about Harry Ricardo? I know he's quite well-respected in the whole engineering world, particularly from the sort of 1930s, 40s, 50s. Who was this guy, Harry Ricardo?
Well, he actually had been an apprentice machinist with Harry Ricardo, and he became to be very, very skilled. And Ricardo's were doing development work for many other companies at the time under contract. And whenever there was something difficult to make, he and some colleagues who worked other sorts of metal working machines, always got the job. So they had a machine shop there that was very famous indeed.
But I mean, what sort of world were they working in? Was this cars? I mean, that was a big thing in the 30s, wasn't it?
It was cars, it was marine engines, and I think also fire engines, later on aeronautical engines. But you have to remember that I was a very little boy at this time, so my memories are a little hazy, as you can imagine.
So what was your dad up to there? I mean, he obviously was doing... I mean, could you just take us through that whole thing of being an apprentice machinist? What did that actually mean?
Well, what that meant was a company would approach Ricardo's and say, look, we've got a problem with the smooth running of this new engine that we've got, and we would like you to look into what's wrong with it and how to improve it. So there'd be a drawing office and designers there who'd take a look at it and say, oh, the shape of the combustion chamber is a bit wrong. And they draw up a new one, and my father would make a one-off out of solid metal. And then that would be tested and back to the drawing board and tested again. And finally, they would find the answer, and that would be the end of that job and move on to the next.
So what we're talking about here is the cutting edge, I suppose, of engineering, which is research and development.
It was exactly that. They call themselves experimental engineers.
What did exactly did your dad work on then? Anything specific?
He worked on a big American milling machine made by a big company called Cincinnati. I just remember seeing the name on the side of the machine as we speak.
And how did he progress through Ricardo's then?
Well, actually, he loved machining, and he had lots of ideas that he passed backwards and forwards to the designers and worked closely with them. And I think he often spoke to visitors from the company who are sponsoring the design. But he never wanted to leave the machine shop. He liked it there very much. But he was always very interested in what was going on.
Now, they also, I can remember chatting to people in my youth who were tool makers. Now, these were the sorts of jobs where you're not actually making stuff, you're making the stuff to make stuff with.
Yes, he was a tool maker by trade, yeah. And you needed to be. I mean, he was making things like aerofoil blades for jet engines, something that had never been done before.
Okay, so this is, I mean, is this working on the first jet engines? Because I would imagine if this is the 30s and 40s, that's when they were invented, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. And I remember him talking about the work he was doing for Harry Ricardo. Of course, a lot of this work was commercially very sensitive, if not secret, because remember, this was around the war time, the Second World War, and they were doing a lot of work for the government as well. So he couldn't really talk about very much, and I suppose he thought just because I was a little boy, it didn't matter. So I think I do know a little bit about
you're in on some of the top secret stuff of World War II, but how did they come to actually decide that a jet engine might be the way forward? Because, I mean, I suppose up until then it was just simply propellers, that was all.
Yes, well, I know this from because I became an engineer as well. And I know from my later life why it happened. They were looking for faster and faster aeroplanes, and they'd reached the limit of what a propeller plane could do. So it had to be something else, and the something else looked like being a rocket plane at one time.
But what was the limit? What was it about propellers that were limiting aircraft then?
Well, I think it's the tips of the propellers. As you rotate them faster and faster, the tips of the propellers start to break the sound barrier, shall I say. And at that point, they become less and less and less efficient. And that just is self-limiting.
So could you just take us on the basic principles of a jet engine? How does that work? That it is not a propeller, it's not. But it has actually like lots of little propellers inside it, doesn't it?
Well, we have to start with thinking about a rocket. And you can think about a firework rocket. What happens there is you burn some chemicals, which produces a lot of gas and vapor, which roars out of the back at very high speed because it's almost exploding, but not quite, but it's really burning fast. And the reaction of all this gas spewing out of the back pushes the firework up in the air. And that's really the basis of, all rockets. You're burning something and expelling it out of the back, and it can lift tons and tons of rocket these days. But that wasn't no good for commercial aircraft. What the people that developed the jet engines, and it was more than one, because it was a close-run race. I don't really know the detail, but I know there's more than one. And what they decided to do was just to compress air and squirt paraffin into it, set fire to it, and expel that out of the back. And that's how the original jet engines work, and they still work on the same fuel today.
Well, they do, don't they? It's basically paraffin. People don't always realise that. They call it kerosene, AvTur. It's got on the side of the bowsers on the airfields now, but it's still the same principle. But look, hang on. They had various different jet engines they were making. I thought it was all they were all built in Gloucester by Frank Whittle.
Well, yes, but there were other people working on the same idea.
What about you yourself as an engineer? Is there anything that you know, what was the satisfaction you got from it? Is there any projects you worked on that you really felt, wow, that was well worth it?
Well, I started work in the Atomic Energy Authority at Harwell as a scientific assistant when I was 18. And I had to do some metalworking while I was there, but I never became an apprentice or anything because I got interested in electronics, and I learned about electronics because that was moving at that time. I mean, I'm talking about, 1958, and electronics was really moving fast at an incredible rate because we'd gone from valves to transistors to integrated circuits, and then microprocessors, and more or less every month there was something new came out, and being Harwell, it had to be at the front, so we had to learn something new every month. It was very interesting.
So is there anything specifically that you're allowed to, I don't know if it's official secrets or anything, but is there anything that you worked on that you thought once it was actually up and running and working that you felt, you know, you'd played a part in satisfying job?
No, I value my freedom.
Right, so it's all secret still.
None of it has actually come to full fruition yet, but there's lots of things being done in lots of places in the world that stem from some of the things that the team I was part of.
Anyway, I could tell you a little story about Cullum, because I went down there when I was living in Oxford as a guest of one of the physicists there.
If you're going to talk about the JET project, you are on the right lines, yes.
Yeah, because they were looking at fusion. And the physicist, yes, I was with, was one of the first things she said was, the fusion will never work. Because they took them quite a long time to actually make this donut thing get up to the right temperature. And then when it did, it took almost the entire power of the entire national grid plus electricity from France just to get it up to the right temperature. And it wasn't producing hardly any electricity. So,
yes,
I mean,
but you see, the thing is, that was before they were able to develop superconducting metals. The whole thing about fusion is that you've got a plasma at a hell of a high temperature, and it's constrained by a magnetic field to run around a circular pipe called a torus, and the magnets keep the plasma away from the walls, because if the magnets ever lost their steerage and the plasma hit the wall, it just burn a hole straight through it, and that was that. Because they were vacuum vessels, you know, there was supposed to be nothing inside of them. So that was the thing, and those magnets had, as you said, had to be enormously strong, used an exorbitant amount of power. But with superconducting magnets, of course, and rare earth magnets, they've managed to do it much more efficiently.
Well, one thing she said as a physicist was actually there is quite one use for this fusion reactor, and that is that they can try out materials that might be used in a nuclear weapon that without actually having a live test. And that was her slightly cynical approach to it as a physicist was, well, it means that we can, you know, sign the test ban treaty and we can do our tests inside the what they called the project in the joint European Taurus instead. So, yeah, in a way, it was all under the guise of a civil project, but there was quite a lot of use for the military. And there's quite a lot of stuff which is probably still secret about this, Alan, which I won't press you on. But anyway, the book actually about Ricardo Engineering is called The History of Bridgeworks. That, I suppose, is the place in Shoreham where your dad was working, was it?
Yes, it was. The bridge is an old toll bridge across the River Ader, and it's right next to the Shoreham Airport, where there was the tragedy where the pilot lost control and crashed onto the main road.
What do you think's the state of engineering in Britain these days? What's your take on it? Because a lot of people are saying that actually most all the engineering jobs have gone abroad now.
Well, I think engineering's alive and kicking. We've still got some of the best brains in the world here. And yes, the results are quite often exported. But there's no getting away from the fact that the invention and the progress from, shall we say, prototype through to the finished job is often done by not only engineers of that name, but people like quality control engineers. I mean, there was a time when if you said something was made in Japan, people would laugh at you. You know, you're not going to use that, are you? It would blow up in your face. And suddenly, Japan was selling stuff here that was a quality that we had no idea how they were achieving it. And the people that did know were actually British quality control engineers working for Japanese companies. So to that extent, you're right. There was a big export of brain power. Brain drain, do they used to call it? But the place is still full of it. And the British universities, some of them, you know, are turning out top-rate engineers all the time.
But can you point to anything which is like an amazing invention, like the jet engine or the truck, you know, the locomotive, railway locomotive, which is stuff that the Brits have produced in the past, or television or something?
Well, try the hovercraft.
Well, that was invented decades ago. It must be, 40, 50 years ago?
Still in use.
But what about anything that we're doing today, inventing today, and is coming onto the market, Alan?
Well, when I left the Atomic Energy Authority, I went to work for medical equipment companies who were trying to get ahead of the game by using electronics, because there had been very little electronic medical equipment up until that time. And we still actually do lead the world in things like scanners and all sorts of high-tech stuff. And all this DNA and the analysis of DNA, it was all carried out here by university people, you know?
So the book is The History of Bridgeworks. The author is E.M. Soar, S-O-A-R. 90 yep. years ago, Ricardo Engineering was doing it in Shoreham, and apparently we're still doing it here today in the UK. Alan Balding, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Mark Wadsworth. I'm the producer, director of Divided by Race, United in War and Peace, a film about Caribbean war volunteers from the Second World War, which was made into a BBC film, Fighting for King and Empire, Britain's Caribbean Heroes.
Why did you choose that as a subject?
I chose it as a subject because my father, who is from Jamaica, joined up to the Royal Air Force in the Second World War. Unfortunately, he died in 1989, so he didn't live for me to make the film. But I felt as someone who was a journalist, a reporter, presenter, who had the skills to do it, that this bit of hidden history should be brought to the public's attention. No point complaining that bits of black history have been airbrushed out of the history books. do something about it. So I decided to make this film, and I got money from the lottery to make it. They liked the idea.
Can you tell us some of the things you found out whilst you're making the film?
Well, quite difficult to get hold of the veterans. They're actually in their 90s now. There's no register or directory of Caribbean Second World War veterans. So I literally had to pound the streets, go to the Royal British Legion. Fortunately, I had an in with the West Indian Association of Service Personnel, which is an organization that has veterans in it. And so I was able to use their contacts to find some tremendous characters, people like Sam King, who went on to become the first black mayor of Southwark. Alan Wilmot, the uncle of Gary Wilmot, the entertainer. Peter Kempston, Ulrich Cross, Cy Grant. These are great personalities. Unfortunately, some of them had died, so I had to talk to relatives of theirs, their wives, their daughters, and interview them and use archive footage to fill in the gaps.
Now, fascinating stories to tell. Well done for digging out this bit of history. But one imagines that at the time, Britain was still kind of a colonial power in World War II. Was there any racism still around against these people?
Of course there was racism in the colonies. There were two classes of citizens. There were the white colonials who ran the Caribbean and the black subject people who didn't run the show. But when the service men, and they were mainly men, though there were some women, came to Britain, they were welcomed with open arms. Because don't forget, there'd been the devastation of the Blitz and the Battle of Britain. And Britain desperately needed manpower, because so many hundreds of thousands of men had been killed by Hitler's Nazis. And so the black volunteers who came to this country were welcomed with open arms as saviours, in a way.
All right. Can you tell us where and when we can watch your film?
Well, it's available on DVD. The film's available on DVD, and I don't know. People can contact me by email on justice4, that's the number 4, mark with a C, info@gmail.com.
And is it going to be shown on TV?
It's shown by the BBC from time to time, but the last screening was in April, so we won't have another screening until 2020. But I am showing the film around the country, in Luton, in Bedford, and I've showed it in Croydon, where I live, and possibly be doing that again in Black History Month.
Well, we want to know, here in Bristol, we've got a big West Indian community here. We want to know
You'd like to get me an invite to Bristol, I'd be very happy to screen the film.
Mark Wadsworth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Ehsan Khoshbakht. I am a filmmaker and a festival director. I'm the co-director of a festival in Bologna, Italy, called Il Cinema Ritrovato. And the festival in Bristol, which is called Cinema Rediscovered, is inspired after this festival in Bologna. What we do is showing classics, restoring them, preserving films. So it's all about the past. It's about the glorious moments in the history of motion pictures. And now I have made a film, which is about, again, the cinema history, but from a very different angle. Or I should say that the film I have made is about a part of film history that many people are not aware of. We are very happy that we can, you know, as filmmakers, that now we can make films cheaper and without the need for thousands of extras and big studio money. So that has opened up all new possibilities. So I try to use the new possibilities for digital filmmaking, essay filmmaking, if you like, to look back kind of rediscover the history of Iranian cinema from before the revolution. But I decided to narrow it down to commercial films, popular films, genre films. The reason I did that was because the Iranian art house films were already very well known in the West, especially after the revolution, but to some extent, thanks to people like Abbas Kiarostami and Dariush Mehrjooi.
Well, I mean, it's easy for you to say that, but I think there's probably quite a lot of British people who've never seen an Iranian film. Can you just sum up what makes Iranian film different and how it's known in the film world?
Well, I guess probably Iranian films are well known in the West and especially in festival circuit because of their humanism, because of their look at issues like, you know, class, poverty, with kind of a sense of, with an approach which would remind many people, especially in the West, of Italian films made after the Second World War.
Oh, okay.
You know, films like Bicycle Thieves, Umberto D, films which were dealing with really grave matters in a very tender, humanist, and even poetic way. If I want to give you some names from before the revolution, one of the films which is very well known is The Cow. It's about the man who is in love with his cow, which is the only cow in a very poor village. So this is an absolute classic. And then, you know, the films by Abbas Kiarostami, he made a whole series of films for children before the revolution, but these films, which were seemingly for children, became classics because he was using the children as a pretext to talk about other issues and making really strong philosophical films using the children only as their starting point. So any film by Abbas Kiarostami, he gets regular screenings in this country, and I believe that his films will be back on the screen towards the end of the year or maybe next year.
No, I think I'm going to have to be really boring and ask you how to spell that, because if people are trying to look him up and maybe even...
Kiarostami, Abbas is A-B-B-A-S. Kiarostami is K-I-A-R-O-S-T-A-M-I.
Okay. Kiarostami. Fantastic. Yeah. Okay, so can you tell us about your film then?
So, forget about Iranian art house films. Picture this. You know, when we mention the name of the country, Iran, everybody thinks of, you know, forced veiling and hijab. Of the type of government.
Well, you know what I think of? I think of tankers at the moment. That's all we get on the news about Iran is more tankers.
Gulf. Yes, yeah. But now this is the picture I'm trying to portray in my film. How about a society which is obsessed with anything modern and is imitating Western genres, especially Hollywood genres, like gangster films, musicals, and there is lots of sex and nudity and violence and seriously politically incorrect things in these films made in a country which is, you know, basically a Muslim country. So there's definitely a contradiction here. And these films are used to be extremely popular, and people were going watching these films. So just imagine Iranian version of Carry On films or all those sexploitation films made in this country in Britain in the 60s and 70s. Imagine Iranians were doing exactly the same thing. How? Why? What happened to those films? What happened to those stars? What happened to those filmmakers? These are the questions I'm asking, because suddenly the revolution happens, and these people, the filmmakers, they lose their jobs overnight. The stars are all banned, and most of the films are destroyed. All of them are banned. So this is like a secret history of Iran in 20th century. That's the concept of the film.
So is it part of a bigger festival?
It is part of the Cinema Rediscovered Festival at Watershed in Bristol, which is a festival designed to show classics, important films from the past, rediscoveries, and new restorations. It's an absolutely wonderful festival. I go there every year, and it's getting bigger every year. And this is, I think, probably my favorite film event in Bristol every year.
Is it an 18 rated, 21 rated film? I mean, it sounds as if it might, if you're saying sexploitation, it might not be suitable for young people.
I think the rating of the film is 15. So it is true that many of the films that I have that I'm showing as clips in my documentary are films which are, you know, kind of not suitable for children. But one of the things that I have done in the film is to kind of take away or get rid of that troubling gaze in the film, if you know what I mean, because especially regarding women, these films, you know, sexploitation films, the way that women are portrayed, it's really questionable because it has a certain function. So part of my job in doing this film, especially in working with my editor who lives in Bristol, Niaz Sagari is her name, was that I told her, look, when we are editing the film, if you felt at any point that I'm including a clip only for the pleasure of showing that, because, you know, that is really troubling, just cut it out. So that was the deal we had. So this is a film that I have made, fine, but I also had a very strong female point of view to make sure that, you know, we are not taking any visual pleasure in putting together all these clips and scenes of, you know, of nudity, of women being subject to violence or anything like that. So okay. it's been a very conscious process, let's say.
Okay. For those who are interested in film generally, maybe don't go to the cinema like me very much these days to see the big Hollywood blockbusters, are there magazines, websites, or are there places that people can go to follow some of the best in independent filmmaking?
Since we are in the UK, I think it's impossible to not mention the magazine Sight and Sound, which is published by the British Film Institute. This is the oldest film magazine in the world and the oldest running film magazine in the world. And usually there are reviews of all new, interesting new films, films which are not part of the mainstream cinema. They also review some of the more important mainstream films, true, but the focus is mostly on films which are essential to see in this country. So I would say Sight and Sound is, and they also have a website, and the website usually publishes content which is not part of the magazine. So I think it's a way, it's a good way of, you know, catching up with new independent films from all over the world.
Fascinating. Eshan Koshbakht, which is amazing, really, that you've discovered, for many people watching, will be the first time they ever knew that Iran had its own kind of carry-on tradition. Fascinating to talk to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you so much. Thanks for calling me.
Well, that's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviews, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Paul Tanner from Leavers of Bristol, Alan Balding, the engineer, and Mark Wadsworth and Eshan Koshbakht, the filmmakers. Thanks also to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the national volunteering website do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my 2-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Hey, little girl, comb your hair, fix your makeup. Soon he will open the door. Don't think because there's a ring on your finger, you needn't try anymore. For wives should always be lovers too. Run to his arms the moment he comes home to you. I'm warning you. Day after day, there are girls at the office, and men will always be men. Don't send him off with your hair still in curlers. You may not see him again. For wives should always be lovers too. Run to his arms the moment he comes home to you. He's almost here. Hey, little girl, better wear something pretty, something you'd wear to go to the city and dim all the lights, pour the wine, start the music. Time to get ready for love. Dim all the lights, pour the wine, start the music. Time to get ready for love. Time to get ready. Time to get ready for love. Time to get ready.